This is Line Break, where we deconstruct poetry written by young writers and discuss the inspiration and intention behind their poems. Take a pause and enjoy the line breaks. Here's episode 22, where I talk with Fun Is a Necessity about her poem in praise of plainclothes poetry. I hope you enjoy.
My username on YWP is Fun Is a Necessity, and my poem is in praise of plainclothes poetry. I'm uninterested in poetry that wants to take it out of me. That's not quite true. I really do sometimes truly like it. I get a sadistic urge to be talked down to, and I pick up something by T.S. Eliot, whose name is spelled with just one L, defying me and expectation. I look at his allusions and feel smart for my efforts to get in on the jokes via a combination of English degrees and internet research. Such costly comprehension, though, cannot be my daily bread. I cannot subsist on fussy macarons and souffle that drops when bumped. I need plainclothes poetry that is willing to risk being called trite and ordinary in a valiant effort to protect and witness my soft and lazing heart. I love it when words are just words, surface level, beautiful, without demand for further searching. I love words that reward attention anyway. I love words that do not push me into their wit-crafted ravines of confusion, but instead help me climb dust-covered and bewildered out of my own.
Great. Thank you so much. What was your inspiration for this?
I remember having a conversation with my friend Will, and he was saying, oh my gosh, I really don't like poetry. And I was like, no? Then maybe you haven't found the right stuff yet, because I think we get this idea in our heads that poetry is something that's like difficult and complicated and obtuse and just like obnoxious, and that it's for like quote unquote smart people, which is like a problematic concept all on its own. And I remember telling him, like, there are so many poets out there who are really just saying what they're thinking, and they're doing it in an artful way, but it doesn't have to be so hard, and that there's a lot of fun in it, and that there can be a lightness, and yet there's, like, a place for these harder, more complex poets. And so really, like, finding that bothness, which is something that I think runs through, like, every chunk of my work and my existence, is like this moment where I'm handed an and or choice, and I would like door number three, please.
That's cool. So there are so many great lines in here, and some of them that stick out to me are, I'm uninterested in poetry that wants to take it out of me. I get a sadistic urge to be talked down to. I feel smart for my efforts to get in on the jokes via a combination of English degrees and internet research, which is very, very good line. I need plainclothes poetry that is willing to risk being called trite and ordinary. And I think that this is definitely relatable, wanting to find and read poetry that's ordinary but still well written. And like you were talking about, people just think that a lot of poetry has to be so serious and like wordy and old-fashioned and very, very proper and formal. And that's the kind of poetry that makes me not want to write. Whereas if I read something that's a little more modern and like kind of humorous and takes a new kind of look on the world and different matters and stuff, then that inspires me. But I just don't get as inspired to write when I read those like stuffy poems. And I was wondering what you look for in poems and books that you read. Like, do you want something that inspires you to write your own, or...
Yeah, what do I look for in things that I read? Oh gosh, it's so funny because yesterday I was in this process of interviewing for a job potentially teaching a poetry class. And they were saying, well, you know, make sure you've got your resources together. What would you pull together for a syllabus? And I was like, oh, I get to write my own list of poems after having been through, you know, college and the beginning of a master's program and being in the midst of that and getting so many other people's collections, to get to kind of pull together my own collection. And now I'm looking across my desk, like some that I had come up with. Oh my gosh, I put Ross Gay on here twice. He is this incredible Black poet who really captures nature and joy and vulnerability and like the human life cycle in a way that brings me a huge amount of joy. I really appreciate David White. My favorite poem is by Alice Walker, and it's called Expect Nothing. Love E.E. Cummings. There was a chapbook. I think the title of the chapbook was Citizen Illegal, and I'm sadly forgetting the name of the poet who wrote it, but I remember adoring that and being exposed to that at my master's program. And then like some of the like classics, like I love Frost and his obsession with death. I just think it's charming. and Emily Dickinson is perpetually blowing my mind, and I love that she refuses to choose words. She's just like, I have three ideas and I plan on including all of them. Good luck reading this out loud. And like, I even really appreciate like Longfellow, the Psalm of Life, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait is something that I've had up on my walls for ages. And so I think it's like mirrors and windows. I'm looking to see something of myself and be like, I'm not alone. And then I'm also looking to get some sense of how somebody else sees the world and kind of stretch what I can think and who I can be in witnessing that.
We've talked about that before, of like wanting to see yourself in poetry and books and then wanting to see another world. And I was actually just recording the second part of the 20th episode, and I was talking about how I want like a lasting effect in the poetry and books that I read, where if I one day I want to remember something a few days later. And I don't want it to just be with me in the moment. Do you find that you want that too?
Oh my gosh, yes. I absolutely hated Expect Nothing the first time I read it, which is that poem by Alice Walker. And I was handed it by my English teacher. And also just thank you so much for having me here. I didn't get a chance to say that at the beginning, but I'm so grateful and excited and honored to get to be in this really cool space that you've created. So first of all,
Of course. Thank you. I'm so glad to have you here.
The first time I encountered this Expect Nothing poem, I was handed it by my English teacher. And I was like, this is the most dismal thing I've ever seen. I don't want to expect nothing. I am a good student, TM. High expectations are my jam. I joke and I'm like, I'm a recovering A student, and I really feel that deeply in my soul because it didn't do good things for my brain. And so I've kind of grown into this poem, and I might butcher it a little bit, but the beginning of it is expect nothing, live frugally on surprise. And I've grown into this idea of, you know, lowering my expectations for my relationships, lowering my expectations for outcomes, and kind of softening into process and ambiguity and bothness, and not trying to be for or against things. There's another chunk of it that says, wish for nothing larger than your own small heart or greater than a star. So it's that moment of like, absolutely be with yourself and then be with the universality of everything. And recognize that like what you're going to have is going to be enough. And so you don't need to kind of future trip and come up with all of these expectations to kind of hem in what is possible for you. And I didn't like that. I really like certainty. And so growing into more comfort with those possibilities has been really fun. And now that poem kind of, it just kind of winks at me from the wall and keeps me company whenever I start going to that moment of like, I want reality to be a certain way, which has just been such the fight we can take on with everything that's going on right now.
Oh yes, I can definitely relate to that. Just like, to know what's going to happen in the future and like not just let it happen to you and like wanting to make it happen. And I definitely get caught up in like thinking about what I'm going to do next and like what my goals are, what I have to achieve, and like, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it perfectly. And then I just kind of get in my head and I freak myself out. But It's good to be able to go back to a poem or a book or just any words of any kind and feel like that's the kind of area where you can just be yourself and learn from it and gain knowledge and wisdom.
I'm looking for recommendations. I know you're interviewing me, but I love it when it's able to be a conversation. Do you have poems for you that you feel like you're growing into, or they've just kind of like latched their little like cat claws into your shoulder? And just
good question, because the podcast coming out tomorrow addresses all of that. And I read a couple of poems that I've kept going back to over the years, and I've talked about why I like them. But one of them that I really like that I actually read in that episode is, it has a very long title. On this, the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, we reconsider the buoyancy of the human heart. It's very long, but
I feel like I've heard that title before. Say more.
Yeah, it's the greatest poem. It's by Laura Lamb Brown Lavoie, I think. And I love it. I keep going back to it. I find something new in it every single time. And it's just so beautiful. But it's about this idea, the final line actually is, there are enough ballrooms in you. Oh. And the narrator goes down to the bottom of the ocean and talks to the Titanic, and she's like, teach me how to sink. I'm so sad. My love is leaving me. I don't know what to do. And the Titanic's like, I don't know how to teach you. It just happened to me and stuff. And there's enough time for you to figure everything out. And it's just so amazing. I really love it.
My whole heart.
I know. It's the greatest poem. So that's definitely one that I've gone back to again and again. Oh my gosh. I just have a bunch of random poems, I think, that I found over the years that I write down or I put on my wall. I have two walls that I've been taping quotes and poems to for the past like 5 years. And it's kind of like being in my brain sometimes.
Same. I just moved into a new apartment, so my walls are a bit bare, but they're already starting to accrue quotes, and I've just got like packing paper from boxes stuck everywhere with stuff written on it. And it's just like people come into my room and I'm like, oh, guy in like the movies with like strings stuck between papers.
Yeah, me too.
it's all connected.
I have a lot on my wall that I just kind of gathered over the years, and I haven't added to it in a while, but it's kind of cool to sometimes just stare at my wall and see how I can get inspiration from these like little bits of poetry that I've written down. Back to your poem. My favorite line is, I love it when the words are just words. And what was your inspiration for this?
Ooh, when the words were just words. I don't like to fight my literature. I don't like to have to chew too hard. And I think part of that is maybe laziness, but I'm giving laziness a new story. I'm calling it efficiency. It's like that, I don't know who said it, but somebody said something along the lines of, give a lazy person a hard problem because they'll find the most efficient way to solve it. And I like to think that that's how I exist in the world. And so I love it when my poets are kind and they just hand me something and they're just like, so, you're going to get something out of this on the surface level, and it's going to be this beautiful description of like a river. I think Mary Oliver does this pretty well sometimes, where, huge fangirl of hers, oh my goodness, where she'll give the surface level description and, you know, she'll be talking about, you know, wild geese flying through the air. And then you'll get to one of these lines where she tells you, you do not have to be good. And you're sitting there and you're just like, Mary, what are you telling me? That is too much for me to consume right now. And you've hung all of these images around it so that it's just like this wind chime, and you kind of shake it and you're just like, whoa, that is beautiful and it's so much, but I know exactly what it is. And then there's other poets where you get their work and it's like a junk drawer where you pull it out and you're like, I don't even know how all of this connects, but some of it is fascinating. And it's like, I don't know what this key goes to. And I used to kind of resent those poets and just be like, I don't know what you're doing over there. But now it's this moment of like, oh, okay. Sometimes I need the wind chime. Sometimes I need the junk drawer. And like, sometimes I can just hang the key in the middle of the wind chime and it dings some interesting notes off of, you know, the poems that I already feel like I understand. Yeah, that kind of combination of both. But I love it when the words are just words, and words are always just words. And so I have a hard time not loving whatever comes across my desk if I really think about it and am well rested enough and, you know, have eaten breakfast and can be patient.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I remember I read a collection of Mary Oliver's poetry for my 8th grade English class. So it was actually a high school poetry class that I took at
the
time.
Good class.
I know, it was so cool. And that kind of like launched me more into my poetry writing. But one of her poems, I'm not sure which one it was, but there is a line about, tell me what you want to do with your one wild and precious life. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Yes.
That's just such an amazing line. But I think it was like kind of hidden in like these descriptions of wildlife and like bears and hummingbirds and birds. And it's just so cool how she kind of like weaves those together. And I have so many of her lines on my wall.
She calls you out too.
Oh yeah.
Like you're sitting there and you're just like, oh yeah, I was told Mary Oliver was a great nature poet. And then she's telling you, you know, just let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And you're just like, Mary, you're telling me that, like, I just need to trust myself? That's too far. Like,
yeah, wait. I thought we were talking about geese here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I really remember her poetry back when I was first starting to get into it. That's so interesting thinking now back to, like, the poems that stuck out to me and, like, inspired me when I was first starting out, because I feel like I didn't really dig that deep to find anything interesting. I just kind of accepted the first things I found. And now I feel like I've kind of explored more poems and found more poets that I can really relate to and get inspired from, and not just like the first things that I find in the collection of poetry. I was wondering, how do you find new poems and poets to read?
Again, I was dealing with this syllabus dilemma. And I was like, okay, well, this is what I have. And there's been, I think, this like collective imagination renovation that is happening in terms of what authors get to be important in terms of race, in terms of gender, in terms of class, in terms of, you know, religion, whatever categorization you want to break humanity down to, and having, or, and language. I have done some translation, and in doing that got to know that industry a little better, and the percentage of stuff written in other languages that actually makes it into English and becomes accessible to monolingual English speakers is just minute. And so over time, my degree is in literary studies, which is basically was Middlebury College's equivalent of a great books major, and so I got the list, which just has all of these authors and I think one or two women, and you have this moment of like, okay, is this what I'm working with? But simultaneously, this major was one of the greatest sources of freedom in my college experience. That list was only in charge of a couple of little capstone pieces of the major, and the rest of it, I could take any literature designated class in any department. And so if I wanted to go read Spanish literature, or I wanted to go do Chinese literature and translation, I could go on those intellectual adventures. And also, because I enjoyed it and I wasn't stressed out all the time, I made myself a rule that it was a joyful rule. Joyful rules are important. That I had to go to the college library and like once a month or so, just pick up a book off the browsing shelves and just read something new that wasn't assigned to me, so that I didn't kind of poison the well of this thing that I really loved by just doing it as work all the time. And so like just walking through a library is a big thing. And it's just being like, oh, that cover looks pretty, which they say, don't judge a book by a cover. And I say, well, then why is the cover there? Like, you know, it gives a little bit of information about the vibe of the thing. And sometimes it resonates. There's a great little free library, in my town, and
oh my gosh,
sometimes
they're the coolest. I was just talking about them. I've gone to those and gotten so many books from them,
and they just meet you, because you'll just be walking along and you'll open the door and there will just be this book that like has a, you know, maybe a slightly bent cover, and you'll pull it out and you'll just be like, oh hi, How are you? Like, you were what I was looking for today. And then you bring it home and you're feeling pretty good about yourself. And then I've brought, you know, stuff back where I'll have like 5 books I want to get rid of. And I'll just be like, okay, here, these are going to be here now. And I'll be awaiting my next set of inspiration and that and friends. So college, libraries, little free libraries, all of these like external book collections. And then from just relationships with professors or friends. My dear friend Ash Babcock, who is currently writing an incredibly brilliant book about the history of circus elephants. When we were in college, she decided she wanted to host a poetry group. And her brother Stu said, oh, that doesn't sound like a good idea. Who's going to want to come and study more words? Lo and behold, he underestimated how nerdy our friend group was. And so there's been, I don't know, 20 some people on the list, but there's like 10 or 12 of us who would consistently just show up and sit in a circle, and we would all bring a poem and we would read them and just aloud, and then we would talk about them afterward. And I found some that I really like from that, and some of us would even like read some of our own work. And that was like one of those first kind of public performance moments of being like, I guess I'll share this, and I'm so nervous, and like I hope they like it, but even if they don't, they're my friends, and so nobody's gonna vote me off the island. So that was another way. And just browsing on the internet, I love slam poetry, and so YouTube is just the gift of my life from that perspective. Yeah, so many places. Gotta love a good internet rabbit hole. Poets recommend other poets, and then all of a sudden, like, you're in a new world.
Yeah, I know how that goes. But that's so cool that you found a group that you could really connect with and share writing with. I remember my first open mics. I used to go to them all the time, actually. And like regularly, every week I would go and like force myself to read. Even if I was uncomfortable, I was like, just going to read your poem. And
yeah.
I think that kind of like forced me in a way to be comfortable with reading my poetry and sharing it, because really, I wasn't really saying like, well, if you're scared, then just sit down and like, don't raise your hand. I would like write my name on that list right in the middle so I won't have to go first or last. And then, yeah, I think that kind of forcing myself in a way made me more comfortable doing it. Yeah, now that I read my poetry, well, I haven't actually gone to an open mic in a while, but just sharing my poetry in general has just been a lot more easy because of that.
I think what you just said is like really, really important for anybody who might be listening, because like you said, you were forcing yourself to share, but you were also doing it in a way that was so gentle with yourself by being like, okay, I'm just going to show up. I'm just going to read. I'm not setting any expectations for how that's going to go. I'm going to make sure I'm in the middle. And so I'm like taking really good care of myself and, you know, not stretching too far so that I'm going to get like, so that I don't want to do it again. Yeah, that, I think that all of those things are just so important, because people tell themselves, oh, I'm not like a public speaking person, or I'm not a performance person. But I think it's like art, where it's like, on one hand, yeah, it helps if you've got something to say, but everybody's alive, and so everybody has something to say. And it's like, all of those performance-y things are learnable skills. Some people might feel a little more nervous than others, but like, it's learnable and it's gradual. And I think it sounds like you found some supportive context to do that, and like having good people. I don't know if you went with friends, yes, but sometimes sure, that's helpful.
Yeah. And I would say definitely listen to my advice, put yourself in the middle, because if it's your first time going, and like, you do have the chance to sign up on the sheet, or if they just like call up names and stuff. But if you can sign yourself up, do it in the middle, because then you can see how everyone else does it before you, and then kind of copy them. And like, how do they stand at the mic? And how often do they look up when they're reading? And where do they look when they look up? And like sort of things like that. So kind of learn by copying. I think that's kind of helped me a lot with a lot of different things. Just learning in general really is just by copying what I've seen and heard.
So smart. I wish I had you there when I did my first open mic last year, because I was so nervous, and luckily I ended up in the middle. So it was like kismet. I didn't know the strategy, but I ended up learning it.
Oh yeah. And like, that's also from years of doing piano recitals, where like, you have to know, do I bow first and after, or just after? So you always want to be kind of in the middle so that you know how to follow after the other people. But yes, oh my gosh, piano recitals. I've been playing piano for 11 or 12 years now. It's been an extremely long time. And I've gone to recitals, like, it used to be 6 a year, or just like every few months you'd have a bunch of them. And there are judges, and they're like all watching you at the same time to make sure that you don't make any mistakes. And it like kind of freaked me out, actually. And just like the idea of people staring at me and noticing if I make a mistake kind of was there when I was playing piano, and it was also there when I was reading my poetry. You know, because I'm just kind of opening myself up to be stared at, and I'm like accepting that it's going to happen, which is kind of a freaky thing. But once it's over, you feel pretty proud of yourself.
Totally. And you're kind of like jittery for the next little while. I don't know if you feel that, but I definitely. And then I'm super tired. Like, I have to like enjoy the time afterward and then go home and have a snack because I know I'm going to be like exhausted. I have another question for you. Like, listening to you talk about piano, I've been thinking a lot about like interdisciplinary things where you're pulling from different sources, and especially about poetry and music, because I had a kindergarten teacher. I went to Catholic elementary school, and I had a kindergarten teacher who was super excited about singing, and she always would say, singing is praying twice. And so this idea that there's something special about combining, you know, words and rhythm and musicality, like, have you found that your time beyond performance with piano has kind of informed your writing?
I sort of still, in a way, see piano as like an assignment, even though I've been trying to see it more as like a form of expression. I do still kind of feel like I want to make it perfect and I have to be perfect, but with poetry, I don't really feel that way. I feel like it can just be how it is. Yeah, those two are definitely kind of intermingling in my mind now because I started songwriting, which is definitely a combination of those two. I did the Governor's Institute of Vermont's Writing Institute during the summer, and I did the songwriting class, which was really interesting. And also, I've been writing with a group for the Listen Up musical that's supposed to touring next fall. Who knows? But it's been really interesting because we're finishing our second song, and it's been cool to see how, like, I wrote most of the lyrics, and that was basically just poetry to me that sometimes rhymed when I needed it to. And then I did a little bit of piano chords in the background, and I was like, whoa, this is really easy. Like, I know how to do these two separately, but I never would have thought about putting them together. And so it's very interesting for me how, like, this kind of thing that I thought I couldn't ever really do, like composing music, is now suddenly a little easier than I thought it'd be, because I know that, like, well, I know how to write poetry. I know how to, like, make chords on a piano. So I can just combine those, and there's a song that I just wrote. So that's been interesting to see.
I'm so excited for you to be doing both. And I feel like I've heard, isn't the Listen Up musical, that's like a youth written and performed piece, right?
Yeah, I have been writing, well, I was writing part of the script and then working on the song. So I've been on both sides of it, actually. And it's been really interesting because we started working back in November, and now it's been really interesting to see how it comes together and how you can combine like a story with songs. And like, I hadn't really ever been into musicals before in musical theater. I thought it was like a little bit odd, to be honest. But now I'm getting into it, and I'm like, this is really cool because it's combining two things that have always been a part of my life, music and writing. And now I kind of get to make my own.
That is so cool. I've been talking with, so, two friend conversations. I feel like I'm constantly referencing my friends, but I honestly, they are my postgraduate curriculum. My friend Ollie plays cello, and I have been learning guitar. And so they have been playing cello for years and are, you know, good at reading music and kind of have, I think, had more of the experience you've had where it's like, okay, I want to do it well, I'm going to do it right. And then there's me over here who took, you know, a couple months of guitar lessons before being like, my hand hurts in like fourth grade, and then not picking it up again until I was like 20, 4 and found a guitar at Goodwill for $40. And it was like one of those little free library moments of like, ooh, this will be coming with me. And we were talking about like what it was like to practice. And I'm like, I just find a song I like and play it over and over and over again until I get bored. And then I start doing weird stuff with it. And then I had this other interesting conversation with my friend Deanna, who said something brilliant. She said, I am a type A minus person. It's like, I'm not type A, where I like care so much about everything being perfect. And I'm not type B, in that like maybe nothing like really phases me. Type A minus. I'm just like, yes, I think that this is my new like aesthetic. Oh my gosh.
Wow, I never really thought about that, but that makes so much sense now. I guess some people would say I'm a perfectionist, but when I think of perfectionists, I think of people who are like really obsessed with having everything neat and like so organized and orderly. And nothing in my life is organized. Everything's a complete
mess. Me neither.
But I do really want to like make everything perfect. I do. Like all my homework has to be perfect, and I have to get things right the first time that I do it. And I don't want to just like struggle with anything really. So
yeah.
I guess in that way, I am a perfectionist, but I've never really felt like I'm wanting everything to be super duper neat and like obsessing over that aspect, because I think I work better when it's really a mess around me and I can just focus on what I'm doing. Because like for school, in the textbooks, the first thing that they say is like, make sure that you have a clean workspace. And I'm always like, but how am I supposed to work if it's clean? I need notes. I need paper to doodle on. I need pens. Ah! Yes. Like, I get freaked out by that. And right now my desk is like a little bit clean and it's freaking me out, because I feel like, well, there's too much space. I need to have a bunch of things surrounding me at all times. So
there's nothing to play with. It's not a workspace if it's clean.
Yeah, I can't fiddle with anything while I think. So I think it's just like kind of not putting yourself in a box, I guess, which is a whole different conversation, but like type A and type B and just feeling like you're kind of a combination, type A minus. That's really great.
Jumping off of that idea of not putting oneself in a box, to people that I really appreciate that actually combine music and poetry and absolutely not putting themselves in boxes are there's a guy named Rushad Eggleston, who is a cello player. And is it cellist or cellist? I don't know. I think we're going to go with cellist.
I'm not sure.
But he plays a cello, and he just has this like incredibly fun persona. Like, I was introduced to him through this video, I Love Tofu, in which he like tapes a kazoo to the top of his cello. He's classically trained. Has a bow that has a fork taped to it, has a small plate of tofu, and plays a song while joyously eating tofu that's like incredibly musically intricate. And I'm just sitting there and I'm like, who is this person? And I sent it to my mom and I said, Mom, I don't want to be this person, but I want to be this kind of person when I grow up. I found who I want to be when I grow up.
That's like, so not cool.
And it's this. I don't even need to be playing music, but this is the vibe. Because it's like so many different things. It's enthusiasm. It's skill. It's quirkiness. It's absolute refusal to do the things that somebody else might think you needed to do to be important. And like, he's known for being a good cello player, so it's not like he's totally, you know, pushed himself out of the world of people who exist. And the other person that comes to mind is and I'm not gonna know, I think it is it Annis or Aeneas Mitchell, who had written Hadestown. And I didn't know anything about her, and prior to all of this Hadestown explosion, she came to the campus of my grad school, and I watched her and her friend play, I think it's called Child Songs, which is like a collection of ballads, I think. But they were just these intricate, moving stories with gorgeous, gorgeous music layered over top of them. And so that was a project that they had done. And then they did this other project, which is all of this mythology mixed with all of this music. And then that blows up and gets to be really important. And then we've got like Lin-Manuel Miranda sitting over here being like, so I've got a history textbook and I've got some musical experience and I've got lots of friends, and let's just stick all that in a cauldron, mix it up, and then dump it out on a few different stages and see what happens. And I think that willingness to just be like, all right, I'm going to take whatever the unique junk drawer of like things that I've experienced and mix them together in a cauldron with some, you know, boiling water and enthusiasm, and sit around a table with some friends and eat whatever soup comes out, just create such cool things. And, you know, sometimes maybe it's not cool, but if you do it enough times, inevitably something comes out that's interesting. And I feel like that's so much of my poetry, is just being like getting two lines into something, being like, I'll leave it to stew for a while. And then the same theme pops up a few months later and I'm like, oh, cool, I can do a whole page on this. Nice. Having that playfulness where it doesn't have to feel like a writing assignment, like you were saying, where like, oh God, I have to do it the good way. Like Mary Oliver's sitting over here being like, you don't have to be good. And I'm just like, I don't have to be good. Anyway.
Yes. Oh gosh, I definitely agree with that for sure. So I've got a few more questions. I'm tearful for one quick second. What, these are two kind of related questions, and
cool,
sometimes stress people out when I ask them. But what lasting message do you like to take away from this? And what lasting message do you think that other people should take away? Or is it open for interpretation?
Oh, I think it's totally open to interpretation. I think one of my favorite like quotes about authorship, I'm not gonna perfectly quote it, but it's from John Green, where he says, you know, books belong to their readers. And so I really think poetry belongs to its readers. And I think that for me, that's part of, side tangent, but I think that's part of reading classic authors for me, is this moment of being like, okay, cool. You know, I've been handed a canon of dead white guys, but I'm sitting over here. And if books belong to their readers, then me as a queer white lady sitting here across time, you know, picking up that book and being like, okay, this belongs to me now. I get to read this from the historical perspective that you might have been coming from, and I get to decide, you know, what I'm going to get out of it sitting here now. And I want it in the junk drawer of my cauldron because other people think this is good. And I'm going to mix it with lots of other different ingredients, but it's like, you know, it's the leftovers you've got in the freezer that have been sitting there for a while. It's like, oh yeah, okay, we can stick this in here with some like rice and stir fry it up and it's delicious again. It's remixed. But I think from this poem, if I were to have the hubris as an author to like suggest something to pull out of it, I think it's just permission. It's permission for people to read what they want to read. It's encouragement that there's so much different kinds of poetry out there, that there's probably something for you. I think it's an invitation a little bit to just be like, come play, you know, there's enough room in the sandbox for you. Like here's a seat.
I think that it's definitely nice to leave your poem open for interpretation and just to allow other people to take from it what they may take. So some questions about writing. How did you first get into writing?
Oh gosh. I think the oldest piece of writing I have of mine is me writing near Halloween. It was, I think the first couple lines were witches, witches everywhere. They give us all quite the scare. They give us all quite the fright on Halloween night. And so it's just this like little repetitive thing that I came up with, but I was so excited because my mom would always read us rhyming books growing up, like Seven Picky Eaters or Dr. Seuss or like Little Miss Spider. And I was like, Mom, I did it. I made more. I remember there was like a little holographic fish sticker on the page, which is totally unrelated, but I love stickers. It was illustrated. Not well, but it was illustrated. And I think it was that kind of spark of fun of getting to make something that like didn't exist before that sounded cool. And then kind of getting super into like fantasy novels and reading Aragon. And it was this first long chunky book. And I was like, I want to make more of this. And so I started writing this like fantasy novel about elves that lived in trees and went to school, and it was very self-referential because I was like, I want to take a sword fighting class, and so I'm going to include this in my writing. And so I brought it to my sixth grade teacher, and this is kind of the origin story of my commitment to not shooting down people's writing, because I handed it to her and I was like, will you please read this? And I got it back in a couple of days, and her way of loving me through the work, which, you know, she was doing the best she could, because this is how you're trained as a teacher, is to look at things and be like, okay, where is the grammar have issues? And so she had marked it up for grammar, and I was like, no, I just want you to say the story is good and to keep writing. Who knows, maybe someday I will finish it. But those were kind of couple of formative writing memories where it's like making something that didn't exist before, making a world that a character could live in. Like, I remember being in middle or high school and starting to write like YA romance and just be like, I am going to write about a character who's definitely not me, ending up with like these people that like she finds interesting, like this really cute boy, and he's gonna just be so protective and kind and like watch out for her. And I was just like, yeah, that sounds great. Definitely not about me though. I don't like boys have cooties. Like, but my character could be all about it.
Oh yeah, I definitely started to write a lot of stories when I was in middle school. And it wasn't even that long ago, really, but I wrote a lot of stories, and I was convinced that, like, I knew everything about, like, being human and being a teenager. And
oh, yeah.
Even though I was
Me
only,
too.
Like, 14, I knew everything there was to know. There's nothing new that I could find out. And I was like, I'm going to write about love. I've never been in a relationship, but I know what it means to be in a relationship.
Same.
I know. And so I just write, like, love stories, and it always came out a little bit weird because I was so awkward when I was writing it. And it was such a reflection of, like, how awkward I was with people who I liked. And it was just so funny to see how I was trying so hard, but it did not come out right. Yeah, I started out writing a lot of stories when I was much younger. And I always kind of liked writing, but I didn't really get into poetry until, like, around middle school. And then over the past few years, I've really gotten into it. And now, question for you. And
yes.
You're out of high school and college now. And I was wondering how you've kept writing in your life, because as fully immersed in the poetry world as I am, sometimes I wonder, like, how am I going to stay this way? You know, how am I going to keep returning back to this place and not get distracted by all these other things that I feel like I have to do?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the first answer is that I didn't. After I graduated, I just felt kind of burnt out. And so it was giving myself this permission, like, I don't have to write essays anymore and basically give professors what they want. Like, because that was my writing practice for all of college, was just like, okay, you know, I'm going to journal and like write down three little gratitude things for the day. You know, and so you keep it in there where you can. But my idea of what writing was had kind of narrowed into just essays, and essays for other people. And so as I was graduating and, you know, I was moving toward, I thought I was going to be a traditional English teacher, probably in middle school. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was deciding to quit student teaching. And I went and I met with my major advisor in Lit Studies, Professor Donadio, and I came into this brunch at like a little cafe in town, fresh off of a crying streak from talking with my uncle about maybe not doing student teaching, feeling super vulnerable and uncomfortable. And Professor Donadio says, tell me everything. And I'm just like, okay, hold on. You're like an important professor person. I can't just tell you that I'm insecure about my life choices. That was basically what I told him. And I said, you know, I don't know if I want to be a teacher. I don't know if I want to be this like creative entrepreneurial person. And he says to me, I think you have no bad choices, but whatever you do, please keep writing. And I was just like, hold on. You are a professional smart words person, and you've been around my writing and you're telling me to keep writing. I must need to keep writing. And he suggested that I take a class with, he taught a course about almanacs. Robert Sullivan, Bob Sullivan, yes, professor at my grad program, Breadloaf. And so I was like, okay. And so I took the 6 months after I graduated from college, and I tutored and I rested and I played outside and, you know, did non-college student things for a minute and got myself disconnected from having grades run my life. Because I think, like, we don't even realize how much of our life we spend in school having other people tell us whether what we're doing is okay. And then you get done with college and you're like, oh my gosh, I have to tell me whether what I'm doing is okay. And so I had that gap time. And then I got to the summer and I was like, yes, please. Grad school sounds great. I will have grades again, strap myself back into the roller coaster, and took a class on fantasy literature and one with Bob Sullivan. And he's just this super, super quirky dude. And never have I met somebody with more of a professor's philosophy of, like, just throwing whatever happens to be available into the cauldron and stirring it up. And that was our class. It was said that it was about almanacs, but, like, we watched videos about, literally videos about gap-toothed women, like a whole art film about women with gaps in their teeth. And then we made it's like a camera obscura or something like that, where you turn a whole room into a camera and you put a pinprick in a bed sheet and it all reflects. And then we did calligraphy and we made up a whole play about the surrounding mountains. And he told us to keep track of the weather and that it should be short and boring and non-self-referential. And I was like, I've never done writing that is on purpose, short, boring, and non-self-referential, but I'll try it. And it turned out that we ended up with these, like, little haiku-ish things. And he was like, shorten it to 3 words. And I'm like, that's so short. And he's like, it's still writing. And I think that class was just this jumping off point of, like, okay, if this kooky dude can, you know, be a English professor at this fancy, reputable place, then maybe there's a place for my weirdness out in the world. And with that, I kind of just started writing a little bit more and a little bit more, and eventually found gateless writing, which is the kind of practice or methodology that I am now certified to teach. And it just kind of holds as true that being supportive of people's writing is a way to improve and encourage and get people into their voices. And so that's been a huge thing for me in feeling like I can take on the vulnerability that is sharing my words. Long answer to a short question.
Okay. No, I'm so glad that you get to talk about that. I remember something that you said about grades and feeling like that's all that there was. I remember in my English class, I got a B freshman year, I think. And then I got a B during seventh grade year of English. Mm-hmm. And this was, like, that was the only time I've ever gotten anything less than an A in any kind of writing class. And I felt horrible. I felt so bad. I thought it was the end of the world. I was never going to write anything again. There was no reason for me to. I could not find out the difference between who versus whom. Therefore, I can never write again. And it just really got me down. And I started to kind of, like, despise it and get really, like, anxious about, like, is this okay? Is this an A? Like, is this what I want it to be? Or did I, like, make another mistake? You know, I started seeing it as, like, not doing it right. But then I think I just kind of realized it wasn't just, like, one day. It was, like, over a period of time. Like, why am I doing this? You know, if I really love to write and I'm not always going to write for school. There's going to be a time eventually in many years when, like, I can just write for myself. So then I was like, okay, forget about grades. I'm just going to write for myself. And then it was a lot better after that. But yeah, that definitely got me feeling really bad about it. And I think that you shouldn't really let grades get you down about something that you really like, because it wasn't like I had not put any effort into it. I had just maybe not really gone over the material as I should have. So, yeah, that was interesting, because if I get like a B or a C in any other class, yes, I'm upset, but not as upset as I was in English, because I always felt like that's the one thing that I know I'm good at. I'm always going to be good at that.
That's such a like brilliant insight that you had by basically saying, why am I doing this? Because I think that like when it is coming from that place of being like, oh, I just like this as a thing. There's an awesome person, his name is Wendell Britt, and he's teaching an allyship class right now. And one of the things that came up as I'm taking this class is the idea of true choices, which are these things that we do just because we want them to exist in the world. And I think for so many people, writing is that thing. And I think for so many people, school is a place where you can get so much encouragement, and you can also, you know, have people convince you that it's about the paper being an A, or like just because you don't understand grammar, or, you know, I have a couple people in my family who are dyslexic and yet they're brilliant thinkers and so good with words. They just might not spell some things right, or they might, you know, not put an apostrophe in the right place. And that kind of like gatekeeping that sometimes happens in a schoolish setting is just like, I'm like, no, there's so many people who it's their like true, you know, and I think everybody, you know, makes it through their journey the way they make it through their journey. But I would love to live in a world where more people got to feel encouraged and like, you know, not knowing the difference between whom and whom wasn't gonna be something that was held against them. Because, you know, on one hand, teachers will tell you like, oh, don't worry, you know, grades don't matter, especially not at this level. But then on the other hand, they're telling you, make sure you work hard for this grade because it's important because of your future. And you're sitting there in the middle and you're just like, you kind of can have both, but also my like anxious brain doesn't, it can't work with both. Like either tell me, does this matter? Or is this something that like I can let it go so that I can just find some joy here and creativity here? And oh gosh, honestly, if anybody's listening to this and wants to hire me as a teacher, and you're seeing a suspicious amount of A's coming out of my class, it's because people should get to show up how they want to show up. It's important. And if that's a nap for somebody one day, let it be a nap. If that's a gorgeous poem, I'm here for it.
Yeah, I think that it's important to not feel like grades just kind of define you as a writer. Because, you know, your writing doesn't have to be perfect. You don't have to have the right grammar. You don't have to have the right kind of like full sentence and punctuation and stuff. It can just be how you want it to be. You know, how do you want this to be your poetry? So that's what I've been trying to think of. But now that I'm getting into college early, I'm starting 2 years earlier than really? I should be. Yes.
I'm so excited for you.
Yes, it's been crazy. I haven't really talked about it that much because I feel like it's still kind of a little bit freaking me out now. I wasn't freaked out before.
Let me know if you need support.
Yes, I wasn't freaked out before, but now I'm sort of thinking like, oh gosh, everyone's always said like grades don't matter until you get to college and then it matters. And then I'm like, oh, but I think it's still important to remember that that's not just the end all be all, you know? I don't have to be perfectly A's all the time. I can just like succeed in my own little ways.
And so, you don't have to be A's all the time if you can tell a good story.
Yes.
Because you can end up with, you know, a like mediocre grade, whatever mm-hmm. we're going to call that. And if you're able to come to whoever is the decision maker and that changes, but and be like, here's how that happened. Here's what I learned from it. You know, that storytelling ability can do a world of good. You know, unless you're trying to get into some competitive med school, you have mm-hmm. a fair bit of leeway. And even then, you know, mm-hmm. there's nothing you really can't storytell your way out of if you're pretty obnoxiously determined about it.
Yeah, I think that I also get really stubborn about like doing things how I want to do it. And then if I'm supposed to do it another way, then I'm like, no, that's not how I want to do it. So I can definitely be stubborn in that way. For the most part, I think I'm excited for this new challenge because I am very ambitious. I like to be challenged and I like to always have something to like work on and not feel like it's too easy. So it's exciting for me. And I'm going to start ceramics. I'm going to a ceramics class. Woo! That's the first class that I've gotten to pick for school ever. That was just my choice and not like a requirement. So I'm so excited for it. And I'm going to give everyone a pinch pot for Christmas.
Oh my gosh. Let me know if I can put in my order.
Yes, of course. I'm so glad because I feel like this is now my chance to feel like my education doesn't have to be so like strictly math, science, English, history. Now it can be more like ceramics. Just like kind of whatever I want, whatever kind of knowledge I want to gain. And wisdom I want to get.
For anybody who's listening to the audio recording of this, I've just been like over here kind of like shaking my hands in like a happy dance. That first time you get to pick what you're learning is just like intoxicatingly powerful and fun. Hopefully, ideally. I mean, who knows? Maybe you'll pick some things that you don't like and you learn just as much from that. Like, for sure.
It's so exciting to me, really, to just be able to like have a lot more freedom. And maybe you'll start writing poetry about ceramics and combine those two.
Throw it in the cauldron.
Yeah. So a few last questions. How did you discover Young Writers Project and what role does it play in your life?
Oh, I discovered Young Writers Project by meeting the incredible wizard of the whole thing, Susan Reed, at a Vermont Teaching and Learning for the Future. I know it's VTLFF. I think I got the acronym right. Conference. And I think somebody had just been like, oh, you're saying that you really like working with young people and not telling them what to do and like having it be fun. And also you like words, go talk to Susan. And so I talked to her once and she just seemed really nice and like gave me her information. And then, I didn't really have, you know, any particular reason to get back in touch with her. And then this past year, I started my business, Fun is a Necessity, and wanted to be teaching writing. And so I saw her at another VTLFF summit. And I was like, Susan, I'm ready to do a thing. Could I come shadow your workshops and like learn how you all do things? And I thought it was just going to be, you know, me getting to see what an already existing organization was up to. And she was like, sure, you know, let's meet at my office. And then like, I think like 1.5 or 2 hours later, I'm like walking down the steps of the Young Writers Project where it's located and just like skipping down them like a happy little squirrel, because she had been like, so are you looking for a job? And I was like, oh, yes, kind of. I have this thing. And she went and looked at what I was doing and was like, you do things with students? And I'm like, yes, I do things with students. And we do things with writing. And you want to do things with students and writing and schools? And I'm like, yes, schools are okay as long as I don't have to give anybody bad grades. So we were thinking we were going to do some partnership with the schools, and then lo and behold, COVID happens and I've already been teaching online because so much of the gateless stuff is online. And then we kind of shift gears and she's like, well, do you want to teach some like writing salons online for the kids who are a part of Young Writers Project? And I'm like, absolutely. And so, as you know, from being in those, that was kind of how that happened. And I never really expected that it would get to turn into such a joyful ongoing thing, or that I would get to be a part of the work of one of the attendees of the parties. But it has been such an absolute joy. And it's such a supportive community. I think that that's one of the things that just feels so big. Like I wish I had had, you know, I think everything happens for a reason. And I had great experiences, you know, when I was about your age in other ways. But I think that young me would have felt a lot less weird and a lot more supported to have such like a kind group of writerly, artistic, nerdy people around me.
I'm so glad that you've been welcomed into YWP. I've talked to so many people now for the podcast and just in general about Young Writers Project, and it's so cool to see how everyone has kind of come to this general consensus about how like there's so much support and love and just like acceptance and people just saying like, oh, I really connected with this, or I really like this, or I went through something similar. Like, it's so amazing to me how you can connect with people despite differences in, lifestyles and cultures and time zones and all sorts of things like that. So I think that Young Writers Project is really great in that
Same.
way. So one last question. What
Cool.
is the best writing advice you've ever gotten, and what advice would you give to someone else?
My first piece, is just keep writing. That comes from so many things where you hear people just talking about, just create a volume of work, even if it's nonsense, and create it however you need to create it. I started a document when I was 14 where I just wrote down the most impactful things that were happening to me in the most dramatic way, and I password protected it, and I was like, this is my secret spot to write all my serious business. And now it's 100,000 words long and I'm still writing in it 11 years later now. And so I think that that is probably, if you feel like you need to be writing, just let yourself write however that happens. And you'll develop the style and you'll develop the skill. And there's a couple of really great talks that I go to for encouragement. One is Ira Glass, talking about the gap where you're in the game because you have good taste, but everything you create, you're just like, oh, it doesn't quite measure up. And he's like, just keep doing things. And eventually that gap will get closer and closer between what you hope your work can be and what it actually is. And then the other one is Neil Gaiman's Make Good Art commencement speech, where he's just like, whatever happens, make good art. And it's also this really great meditation on creative careers where, he's like, find something that you want to do, and then just keep asking yourself, does this get me closer or farther from the thing that I want to be doing? Because early stages, there might be things that you want to do where it's like, oh, I want to be podcasting. And so maybe you record a voice memo and that gets you closer. But then a few months later, the next step isn't recording another voice memo necessarily, maybe. It's just the next one on the path. And so yeah, there's so much good material.
That's great. Thank you so much for everything that we've talked about today. It's been so great to be able to learn more about your writing process and how writing is a form of your life. This has been episode 22 of Line Break. I hope you enjoyed and stay tuned for episode 23. Bye!